Tentor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Hard Rain, America in the 1960s, Our Decade of Hope, Possibility, and Innocence Lost, by Fry Gilyard. Narrated by Chris Abernathy. I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. It's a hard rain's a-gonna fall. Bob Dylan. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. Martin Luther King, Jr. In our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. Aeschylus, as quoted by Robert Kennedy. Preface. There are many different ways to remember the 1960s, and this is mine. I've used interviews, journalistic accounts, and the work of other scholars and memoirists to add flesh to the bones of personal recollection. I've set out to capture in these chapters, for those who lived it and wish to remember, and for those who didn't but still want to know, the competing story arcs of tragedy and hope. There was in these years the sense of a steady unfolding of time, as if history were on a forced march, and the changes spread to every corner of our lives. As future generations debate the meaning, I also seek to do some of that here. I hope to offer a sense of how it felt. For me, this is history of a personal kind, the story of a decade in which I came of age, and in which my professional aspirations took shape. I graduated from college in the terrible year of 1968, a year in which two assassinations altered the psyche and spirit of the country in ways from which we have not yet recovered. I knew as a journalist beginning my career in that year that I wanted to write about these things, and that the line between history and journalism was thin. In many ways, I think, everything I have written is rooted in that time. Thus, I offer within this book one writer's reconstruction and remembrance of a transcendent era, one that, for better or worse, lives with us still. As our thoughts return to those turbulent times, which they do so often, many of us remember in fragments, in bits and pieces of cherished recollection in which the world seems brimming over with hope. There is the face of JFK, confident and smiling, frozen in memory on the television screen, delivering the words now chiseled on his grave. Now the trumpet summons us again, not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need, not as a call to battle, though embattled we are, but a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle, year in and year out, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation. A struggle against the common enemies of man, tyranny, poverty, disease, and war itself. And there is the image, too, of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. speaking on a temperate summer afternoon, a crowd of 250,000 stretching out before him as far as the eye could see. He has not strayed far from the words on his written draft when Mahalia Jackson, standing nearby, urges him gently. Tell them about the dream, Martin. And we remember how his words then took flight, how the poetry and the cadence blended as he left his printed text behind. I say to you today, my friends, even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Those were defining moments of a decade, the 1960s, when we seemed on the brink of a different kind of greatness, rooted not only in our national might, but in our capacity for introspection. In America, there were men stepping forward to lead us, and women, too, whose passionate voices grew stronger with time, and they seemed to be unafraid of our flaws. For most of our troubled history as a nation, we had seemed not to mean some of what the Founding Fathers had said. Certainly, it was clear that not all men were created equal, nor women either. But now, as the 60s came into focus, we were swept along, many of us, by the frightening power of a patriotic notion. Maybe we could, as Dr. King said, live out the true meaning of our creed. But there were also darker forces among us. For one thing, we were living in fear, which was at the start and at its heart a rational response to our moment in history. On May 1, 1960, 30-year-old pilot Francis Gary Powers was shot down over the Soviet Union. He was on an espionage mission for the CIA, flying his U-2 aircraft at high altitude, gathering intelligence about Soviet weapons. The diplomatic furor that followed his capture was a stark reminder that we were living in a Cold War, a competition between two countries armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, each bomb capable of inconceivable devastation, far beyond even Hiroshima or Nagasaki. In addition to the constant undertow of dread, there was also the political mind game of global competition. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, an erratic, balding man of great menace, given to sudden fits of temper, had promised to bury the American way of life, spreading the doctrine of Soviet communism to every corner of the world. This threat, and the fear of lost freedom it induced, sent shockwaves through the American psyche, pushing us toward a faraway war. All of this, too, was a part of the 60s. Our escalating war in Vietnam, and after a while the protests against it, became enmeshed with the turbulent demand for racial justice. For some Americans, it was simply too much, and the specter of war and backlash and violence cast its shadow of desperation over those times. I remember a rainy and cold night in 1968 when Robert F. Kennedy came to Vanderbilt, the university where I was then a senior contemplating a career as a writer. Kennedy was running for president of the United States, lifting again the torch of his brother, who was murdered 5 years earlier in Dallas. You could hear the echoes of JFK, the same affront to smugness, the call to something better, but perhaps with another dimension as well. For there was in the message of the younger Kennedy a passionate identification with people who hurt. There are millions of Americans living in hidden places whose faces and names we will never know. But I have seen children starving in Mississippi, idling their lives away in the ghetto, living without hope or future amid the despair on Indian reservations, with no jobs and little hope. I have seen proud men in the hills of Appalachia who wish only to work in dignity, but the mines are closed and the jobs are gone, and no one, neither industry or labor or government, has cared enough to help. Those conditions will change, those children will live, only if we dissent. So I dissent, and I know you do too. I remember as clearly as if it were yesterday his Massachusetts twang, the jab of his forefinger and the tousle of his hair, the enigmatic intensity of his icy blue stare. But there is something I remember even more. When Kennedy arrived in Nashville that night, a massive crowd was waiting at the airport. I never heard an official estimate of numbers, but it took him nearly half an hour to walk from the gate set aside for his plane to the car that was waiting for him outside. It was a journey accomplished a short step at a time through a crowd of people screaming out his name, many of them desperate to shake his hand or merely to touch him as he inched slowly past. It was hard in the delirium of that scene not to think of the afternoon in Dallas, November 22, 1963, when Robert Kennedy lost a brother, and the rest of us lost a president, and shared in the shattered grief and disbelief. Everybody I know who was alive that day can recall exactly where they were and what they were doing when Walter Cronkite delivered the news. President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. I marveled in 1968 that another Kennedy would move so willingly through the throng, even if the hysteria on this occasion was friendly. On the same night, one of his friends in Nashville, a former Justice Department attorney named John J. Hooker, asked him whether the risk was worth it. Kennedy brushed the question aside. "I can't think about it," he said. "What happens, happens." And then it did. In June, in the middle of a similar crowd, a young Arab with a gun pushed his way toward Kennedy and opened fire. Only 2 months earlier, Martin Luther King had been murdered in Memphis. And now the death of Kennedy in California became, in a sense, the end of the story. But now, as we let our minds drift back, we remember a rich and complicated time, not fully defined by tragedy, nor by the eloquence of our leaders. Politics and social movements were only the most obvious piece of that history. There were also artists and entertainers, as well as scientists and engineers, whose creativity in the 1960s helped change our understanding of ourselves and of the country in which we lived. As the decade progressed, there were the discernible straight-line themes: war and resistance, the quest for social justice, and a powerful resistance against rapid change. But there were also the other scattered moments, seemingly disconnected, that added their own enrichment to the times. And I have written about those things as well. In the beginning, and above all else, there was a widespread feeling of extraordinary promise, some of which had begun to take shape in the 1950s. Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King had emerged by then as iconic figures in a civil rights uprising trying to find its way. The nuclear arms race, terrifying as it was already tied to the development of powerful rockets making possible the exploration of space. Researchers were working on the birth control pill, and Elvis Presley and other young artists had ushered in the era of rock and roll by blending the black and white music of the South, their exuberant rebellion suddenly offering a voice and a new identity for the young. And yet, paradoxically, for many of those same young people, the 50s represented not so much a foreshadowing of change as a somnolent time of complacency and quiet that gave them a reason to rebel. Their parents' generation was in need of rest. Its members had survived the Great Depression, some losing fortunes, many more losing jobs, stalked by desperation and hunger as the country threatened to come unglued. Then came a world war in which their strength was put to a different kind of test. On December 7, 1941, more than 350 Japanese airplanes had attacked the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor, sinking half its battleship fleet and killing 2,400 Americans. In retrospect, it was little more than a despicable skirmish in a war where 60 million people would die, a grisly testament to the technology of combat. Of that total, 400,000 were U.S. soldiers. But despite those numbers, we would defeat not only the Japanese, but the evil empire of Adolf Hitler. That was how most Americans saw it, and in the following flush of righteousness and power, the U.S. economy, so recently ravaged by the Great Depression, entered into a period of boom. There was also, beginning in 1952, the steadying presence of Dwight Eisenhower, the first Republican president in 20 years. Calm, battle-tested, and wise, a military hero who seemed earnestly to be seeking peace. Early in his term, he ended the Korean War, which had raged for 3 years, and later he warned of a military-industrial complex, a defense industry that might, he thought, seduce the nation into needless war. Most Americans found reassurance in Eisenhower's message, combined as it was with a surging economy and a growing middle class. But after a while, a kind of monotony seemed to settle in, normalcy on steroids, as one member of my generation put it. In the years following the traumatic experiences of the Depression and World War II, wrote journalist-historian David Halberstam, the American dream meant finding a good white-collar job with a large benevolent company, getting married, having children, and buying a house in the suburbs. Jack Newfield, a young writer whose book A Prophetic Minority would chronicle the rebellions of the 1960s, mocked the sterility of those suburban aspirations when he wrote of his own generation in the 50s. Marry well and early. Don't be a troublemaker. Start a career in daddy's business or in a large corporation, and save up for a split-level home in the lily-white suburbs. Newfield was not alone in his irony and scorn. It was clear as the 50s drew to a close that a restlessness simmered just beneath the surface, a contagious yearning for deeper meaning and purpose. And with the coming of the 60s, it was astonishing how quickly everything would change. Thus, as I began to seek to untangle the interweaving strands of history and memory that together make up the story of that time, I began with a moment in 1960, quite specifically, a midwinter afternoon in the city of Greensboro, North Carolina. Part 1. Possibilities. 1960. We shall overcome. The sit-ins, the subversive joy of rock and roll, Harper Lee and Black Like Me, inspiration from JFK, the pill, a conservative manifesto, a $10 fine. 1961. Ask not. Eisenhower farewell, the JFK inaugural, the new frontier and the race for space, the Bay of Pigs and the freedom rides, the Berlin Wall, Roger Maris and Babe Ruth, a song in Alabama. 1962. If I Had a Hammer. The novelists, Silent Spring, The Other America, A Crime to Be Gay, Orbiting the Earth, Marilyn Monroe, Johnny Carson, James Baldwin, Pete Seeger, Joan Baez, Ole Miss and the Cuban Missile Crisis, George Wallace Wins, A Farewell to Eleanor Roosevelt. 1963. I Have a Dream. George Wallace, Birmingham, The Schoolhouse Door, Medgar Evers, Eudora Welty, The President Speaks, Betty Friedan, Gloria Steinem and Patsy Cline, Dr. King and the March on Washington, the bombing of a church, the assassination of JFK. 1. The Movement. For Franklin McCain, there are moments when the memory of it comes rushing back, the feeling he had when he took his place at the counter, on the padded swivel stool beneath the laminated signs promoting lemon pie. He and his friends had given little thought to the history they would be making. They were barely 18, and only much later did they marvel at the mystery of what they achieved. All they knew on this particular day, February 1st, 1960, was that the world was not what they thought it should be. Everywhere they turned, there were whites-only signs, and a way of life in the South and beyond that was rooted in the common affront of segregation. As a young black man, McCain got the message. The insult was never far from his mind. With Joe McNeil, David Richmond, and Ezell Blair, his three closest friends at North Carolina A&T University, he made a decision so basic and clear that he couldn't believe they hadn't thought of it before. For the sake of their dignity and pride, they simply would not take it anymore. As far as McCain and the others were concerned, the laws of segregation no longer applied. Thus did they make their way on this cold afternoon to the Woolworth's lunch counter, a popular gathering place in downtown Greensboro, and took seats on the white people's stools. It was the first sit-in of the 1960s, the day the sputtering civil rights movement finally came alive. There had been a victory here and there, the 1955-56 Montgomery bus boycott, for example, which introduced the nation to Martin Luther King, but in the intervening years, King had struggled over what to do next. He had preached in pulpits across the South and delivered his speeches all over the world, winning acclaim for his eloquence and passion. But the civil rights movement he was seeking to build was so far a series of disconnected events, a caricature of his dreams. Then came Greensboro, where history began in a college bull session. On the night of January 31st, 1960, it was too cold outside, they decided, to go anywhere, so they gathered, as they had many times, in a dorm room shared by McNeil and Blair. McCain and Richmond were there as well. They were just four college freshmen talking about the world. Their conversation soon turned to the issue of race, and they began to rail against their parents, who had struggled so bravely to make it in America, and urged their sons to do the same. But parents and sons, for no reason other than the color of their skin, were demeaned every day by segregated buses, restaurants, and schools. Why, these young men wanted to know, had the older generations allowed it to happen? Why hadn't they fought back? But then a more disturbing question arose. What had they done, the four of them right there in the room? They talked about the dignity of Rosa Parks and Dr. Martin Luther King, and the heroism of the Little Rock Nine, those remarkable Arkansas high school students who, in 1957, had braved white mobs, eventually with the help of federal troops, to batter the walls of segregation there. but in Greensboro, they themselves had done absolutely nothing. The more they talked, the worse they felt, and their mood sank lower by the hour. "I felt dirty," remembered McCain. "I felt ashamed." Finally, in the early morning quiet of February 1st, just an hour or two before dawn, Joe McNeil looked at the others and demanded simply, "Let's do something." From there, the ideas came in a torrent. They would go that day, no need to put it off, to confront the reality of Southern segregation. Specifically, as soon as their classes were over, they would march to the Woolworth store downtown. That particular establishment was especially galling. The clerks were happy to take the black students' money for school supplies or anything else, except for food. The Woolworth's lunch counter served only whites. McNeil and his friends, who would soon become known as the Greensboro Four, decided to confront that policy directly. They would take seats and demand to be served. Many years later, Hazel Blair remembered the surge of terror when it occurred to him that they were really serious. Like most young blacks of his generation, he knew about Emmett Till, a 14-year-old boy from Chicago who in 1955 visited relatives in Mississippi. Showing off for his country cousins, Till had said something fresh to a white woman, and for that breach of Southern etiquette, he was murdered. His mutilated body dumped from a bridge into the murky Tallahatchie River. Two white men were arrested, but soon acquitted by an all-white jury, despite eyewitness testimony against them. Black parents all across the South warned their sons to be more cautious, or they could become the next Emmett Till. As he tossed and turned in his bed in Greensboro, Blair felt mounting dread. Till, after all, had been murdered for a trivial act, a harmless aside to a white woman, while Blair and his friends were planning nothing less than a frontal assault on segregation. Later, he remembered how he woke up early and called his parents. His mother, Corrine, was a member of the NAACP, and when he asked her opinion, she told him simply to do what he must and to carry himself with dignity and grace. There was nothing more to say. Joe McNeil, who would later become a general in the U.S. Air Force, pointed out that they were all afraid. Under the circumstances, it was normal. The question was how they would manage the fear. For McCain especially, the answer was easy. They might go to jail, or maybe they would even be killed. But in a segregated world, they had to be willing to pay such a price. "We had nothing to lose," he later explained. His anger, quite simply, was stronger than his fear, and he could see that the others felt the same. Their moment of personal liberation was at hand. The following morning, they all went to class. McCain remembered how he fretted through chemistry and English composition until finally it was time to meet his friends. They didn't talk much on the 30-minute walk from campus to town, and when they reached Woolworth's, they split into pairs, McCain and McNeil, Richmond and Blair. They bought school supplies and kept the receipts. Then McCain and McNeil, who happened to be closest, decided to move toward the counter. McCain said they hesitated for a minute, maybe even five, before they took their seats, to the general astonishment of people all around. For McCain, it was a moment unique in his life, a sense of exhilaration and relief. "I can't even describe it," he said. "Never have I experienced such an incredible emotion, such an uplift. As a journalist friend of mine once put it, my soul was rested." But the moment soon became more tense. McNeil remembered that a Greensboro policeman quickly arrived and began pacing back and forth behind the stools, tapping his nightstick in the palm of his hand. "Joe," said McCain, "I think this is it." "Yeah," said McNeil, "I think so." The gesture, however, was merely a bluff, and when the two young men didn't flinch, the policeman seemed confused. So was everybody else in authority, and as Richmond and Blair made their way toward the stools, the waitress tried once again to explain, "We don't serve Negroes here." But McCain replied with manicured politeness, pointing to the school supplies they had bought. "I beg to disagree. You do serve us, and you have." "We have the receipts to prove it," McNeil added stubbornly. The standoff continued until almost 5 p.m., when the Woolworth's manager closed the counter. as stiffly polite as they had been from the start, McCain and his friends got up and left. They reveled in their moment of deliverance, but they knew already that this was something much bigger than themselves. Two things happened that same night, as word of their action began to ripple outward and to capture the attention of the young. On the campus of North Carolina A&T, the Greensboro Four called a meeting of student leaders. They talked about their afternoon adventure and the shimmering possibilities that lay just ahead, and they were startled when at first nobody believed them. Nobody could imagine that four college freshmen, acting on their own, had defied white supremacy and lived to tell about it. The lone exception was Albert Rozier, the student newspaper editor. The following morning, he published an extra edition of the A&T Register, the first in its history, and suddenly it seemed as if the whole world knew. The sit-ins continued that week in Greensboro, and with mounting publicity, the protesters numbered well into the hundreds, with black students joined by a sprinkling of whites. Several hundred miles away, meanwhile, a young black man was driving alone through the hills of Virginia, the radio crackling through the cold morning air. Charles Jones, a theology student at Johnson C. Smith University in Charlotte, was on his way to North Carolina when he heard the astonishing story on the news. Four college freshmen, teenagers, had taken a stand against segregation and called on others to do the same. As an African American, the grandson of slaves, Jones was proud of his ancestors' perseverance and believed that every generation must build on the past. But how? What could he and others like him do to push the cause of freedom even further? At the age of 23, Jones was wrestling with that very question when he heard the news on his car radio. And there, in the loneliness of rural Virginia, he found himself shouting to the great empty sky, "Thank you, God! This is how we can do it!" As soon as he made it back to Charlotte, he, too, called a meeting of the campus leadership, telling his friends, "I don't know about y'all, but tomorrow morning I'm going downtown, and I'm going to do what the students in Greensboro did." And so the sit-ins continued to spread. Jones and his friends began sitting in at a half-dozen restaurants, coming back day after day. There were racial insults and scattered acts of violence as young white toughs came to heckle and threaten, and on the first day a policeman struck a student squarely in her face. But the police mostly were professional, and perhaps more importantly, so were the reporters who covered the story. The local morning newspaper, the Charlotte Observer, recounted not only what the demonstrators did, but their explanations about why. The journalists seemed drawn to Jones's eloquence as he quoted the Constitution and the Old Testament prophets and talked about brotherhood and justice. The stories went out on the national wires, and Jones was sure the Charlotte demonstrations inspired supporters all over the country. Whatever the reason, by the end of February, the sit-ins had spread beyond the South and to more than 50 towns. About 1,000 people, many of them white, formed a picket line around a Woolworth store in Harlem, and students from Rutgers, Antioch, and Yale rushed to join the demonstrations. But it was in the South, the most conservative part of the country, where the roots of social change reached deepest, nourished by leaders whose names are largely forgotten. In Nashville, Tennessee, a city that would soon emerge as the new epicenter of the sit-in movement, three ministers, two black, one white, two of them Southern, one of them not, became the unofficial advisors to a remarkable group of activist students. Kelly Miller Smith was one of those mentors, a Baptist minister whose church was a staging ground for the movement. 3 years earlier, he had volunteered his six-year-old daughter, Joy, to be a civil rights pioneer. The city of Nashville, like a handful of other Southern towns, including Charlotte, Winston-Salem, and Greensboro, decided to begin incremental desegregation of public schools. But instead of starting with high school, as the other cities had, Nashville chose to take its first steps at the elementary level, where prejudice might not be as ingrained. That was the hope. And so on the morning of September 9, 1957, Kelly Miller Smith held tight to Joy's hand as he enrolled her in a previously all-white school. The day went smoothly enough for Joy, but at other Nashville schools, the story was different. 19 African-American children broke the color barrier that morning at a total of 8 different schools, and many were greeted by angry mobs. That night, a bomb exploded at Hattie Cotton Elementary, where a lone black child had enrolled, and a wave of fear swept through the city. But on the morning of September 10th, Kelly Miller Smith once again led his daughter by the hand to the doorway of her first grade.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?